Hello and welcome to Opus on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Gretchen Gondek and I'm very delighted today to have two guests in studio, Drs. James and Catherine March, who you probably know already are at Morningside College and great people and public radio supporters, and they are taking time from their busy schedules to come in and visit with me today about a recording that they did some time ago of the Brahms Hungarian Dances piano duet. Catherine, James, welcome to Siouxland Public Media.
Thank you, Gretchen.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start with a little information for folks who are maybe not aware of your careers, your respective careers. You are both at Morningside College, and respectively, Catherine, Jim, what do you do there?
We both teach piano. Jim also teaches music history, and he's taught music theory for years and years. I taught class piano, and I've taught intro to music, a lot of different courses. And I taught here at Western Iowa Tech for a while, music appreciation, and started the theory program.
And Jim?
Like Kathy said, I teach music history. I've taught music theory in the past. I teach piano. I've taught piano literature and other related keyboard courses over the years. I think we started at Morningside in 1986, so we've been there a long time.
And in the process, you have created a wonderful piano series, which we're going to kind of forward promote during the next hour. I'm excited to hear about that. When did you do the Brahms Hungarian Dances CD, which is what we're going to hear today? And by the way, on the Centaur label and part of our library here at KWIT.
I think the CD was actually released in 2001. And so there were, it was probably a year and a half in the making, from the time we decided we wanted to do it until it actually was released.
Why did you want to do this CD?
Brahms is fantastic, and it's forehand, and we enjoy playing forehand. And this set in particular invites a lot of challenges for forehands at one piano. A lot of the recordings that came out prior to our making this recording were recorded actually on two pianos.
Anytime you play forehand music, there's a lot of gymnastics that go into the process. You get two people sitting at one instrument, four hands on the keyboard. You have to manage to avoid collisions and things like that. And the way the music is written, sometimes there's a lot of intricate jumping around to just get the logistics of getting your fingers over the right notes. And so it was a particular challenge to do these and a lot of fun.
Well, we're going to delve into a little bit of music theory now. Brahms sat down, he took pen to paper and wrote these dances. How does music for two hands become music for four hands?
Well, I think this really never was initially considered to be music for two hands. I mean, Brahms chose the four-hand medium because he wanted these incredible sonorities, and the tradition of writing music for four hands at one piano goes way back, a century before Brahms or more. And I think that he just needed that extra power and sonority that two players could get from one piano.
It also was a different world back in the 1800s, sitting at the piano was how you entertained yourself and your friends. And people would get together and they'd sit down and they'd play duets. And so to have something that was in vogue, I mean, these came out when he was writing these. It was the late 1840s. It was after the Hungarian Revolution. There were a lot of displaced Hungarians roaming the streets of Hamburg, where he was a teenager. And so he heard a lot of these tunes at different get-togethers. At the time that he was writing some of these, Brahms was playing in bars and dance halls. And so he had access to a lot of these tunes and things. And to sit down and take these tunes and play them with friends, that's a social evening back in the 1800s.
So what was the fascination for Brahms, who was a German composer, to capture these melodies?
Well, in the 1840s, hands down, the most famous musician in Europe was Franz Liszt. And Franz Liszt was a Hungarian pianist. And so kind of by association, all things Hungarian held some fascination for for the people. And these gypsy tunes and Hungarian tunes were just wildly popular.
But I think the real source was a man named Romanyi. Edward Romanyi was a Hungarian violinist. And he toured with Brahms for a while. The way this happened, Romanyi was a student of Baim, Joseph Baim, who was a real prominent teacher and also taught Joachim. I don't know if you've heard that name before. But anyway, Romanyi was a kind of an elite kid who was touring a lot. He was Hungarian. And he moved to Hamburg, and he was doing a lot of concerts. And one night, his accompanist was ill. So he asked August Baim, who was a relative of his teacher's in town, you know, do you have an idea of another accompanist? And he said, yeah, there's this kid, Johannes Brahms, who plays pretty well. And Brahms had no name at that time. He was just this kid playing in bars and dance halls. And so Romanyi asked him to accompany. And the story goes that they got together and they rehearsed. And then Romanyi said, you composed too? And he said, yes. And so he played some of his pieces for Romanyi. And Romanyi was so enwrapped in listening to these pieces, they missed the gig entirely. And that the next year, it was 1853, the next year, they toured together. They went traveling together. And along the way, you know, when they would crash, Romanyi would play a lot of these Hungarian tunes, violin tunes, and improvise on them. And Brahms fell in love with a lot of the tunes. And a lot of those tunes are tunes that were used in these forehand pieces later. This year of touring with Romanyi kind of kicked off Brahms's career. He got introduced to Joachim. He got introduced to Liszt. Joachim put him in touch with Robert Schumann, who was a person that was critical in Brahms's life later on. He was a very, very dear friend of the Schumanns. And Brahms started collecting folk tunes. He started writing them down. He started improvising on them. He did some concerts himself in Pest, where he would improvise on the tunes. There's one of the dances a number of people wrote about listening to Brahms improvise on them. And in fact, you can hear Brahms himself playing the first of these dances. It's very difficult to hear, but it's on YouTube. And the old wax cylinder, you know, you can hear Brahms' voice and you hear him playing a bit of it. And if you know the piece, you can tell that that's what it is.
It's so scratchy that you have to know the tune pretty well to be able to pick it out, but it's
okay. pretty cool.
That recording does exist.
How
at least fragmentary.
Oh. So did these enjoy the popularity back then that they do now?
Yeah, and Brahms was a man in his early 30s. He took them to a publisher. He wrote these all down, took them to a publisher in Pest, and asked him if he would be interested in publishing them, and he was rejected. So then he went to Simrock. It must have taken some real guts, because Simrock is the person, is the publishing company that published The Magic Flute by Mozart, published a lot of Haydn's works, did the first 13 editions of Beethoven's works. So Simrock was excited about the project and did it. And they came out in 1867, and they were immediately popular. It was, you know, again, I think, you know, taking us back to the 1800s, people are looking for music to play in their living rooms. This is entertainment. And this combines everything. It's got this wonderful classical composer who has put together tunes that are from the popular genre. I mean, this is crossover stuff, you know?
It's kind of interesting. The first couple of sets of the Hungarian dances were published at Brahms' request without opus numbers, because Brahms considered them to be arrangements and not necessarily original compositions. But there's so much Brahms in there that, I mean, I think they certainly transcend what you normally think of as just an arrangement.
And that kind of goes back to the question that you had about why four hands. Brahms loved really thick textures and a lot of counterpoint. And to have four hands doing this all at once on one instrument, it plays into all the things that Brahms loved, that thick texture in the center of the piano.
And there's a richness and a fullness to the writing that's really gratifying both to play and to listen to.
When were they orchestrated?
I really don't know.
I'm not certain either. As a pianist, I'm interested in the piano
first. Most of them have been orchestrated, though, mm-hmm. particularly the early ones.
And as you said, Catherine, an interesting, we think about an earlier time, and it may be astounding to people, for people to know, there really wasn't, you didn't have TV, you didn't have the internet. And families quite commonly did their own musical little soirees in the evening. And almost everybody in the family played an instrument, didn't they?
Exactly, yeah.
It's part of being a well-educated, refined person to have skills at music.
And certainly if you were a teenager, you know, to be able to sit on a piano bench next to, you know, someone of the opposite sex and brush shoulders as you're playing this lovely music in a soiree, you know, it was a win-win situation, a social event and a musical event and, you know, a way of starting dating. It's how we started dating.
Sounds very romantic, being on the same bench, piano four hands. So how do you, you mentioned gymnastics, and I love that. I'm just trying to get a kind of a visual image here of the two of you doing this. And I have seen you perform together. Talk a little bit about what is involved, and it's a true partnership if you're both playing the keyboard at the same time.
Right. It's not the sum of two parts. I mean, you're doing one thing, and it's two people accomplishing that one thing. And there's four hands going. There's usually one primary melody, and so there's three hands doing some sort of accompaniment, which is an odd thing with balancing. Another thing that's really challenging with duo playing is pedaling, because sometimes whoever's playing the primo part could really use a little bit of pedal to help smooth things out, but that might be blurring things that are going on in the secondo part, and there's only one pedal on the piano, and so working those kinds of things out are really kind of tricky. And then just to have the same artistic vision of what you want to accomplish with the piece kind of requires a meeting of the mind so that you're both working towards the same thing. And there's a lot of things that need to be worked out. The having things occur naturally, accelerandos, retardandos, attacks of chords, you know, beginnings of phrases after a pause or a rest. Those kinds of things are, it takes some time to get those worked out. It's part of the challenge and part of the fun.
So when you were putting the recording together, did you have a coach or somebody working with you on this, or did you just do it all yourself?
We had been playing some of these dances for a very long time. There were only a couple that we had to learn new, I think, for the recording. But we probably started playing together in about 1981 mm-hmm. or so. And so some of these pieces we had probably played for close to 20 years before we made the recording. And we had used them in concerts. That's part of why we thought it would be fun to do a recording of the whole set, is because we knew a lot of them and we loved them. It's kind of like recording a set of 21 encore pieces in a way. But they were just such engaging works that we wanted to put them all together.
So in your preparation, were there any disagreements or philosophical differences in performing the literature?
Well, I would say yes. From beginning in 1981, there were these little places where, you know, we have different ideas about how things should go, but we've played together long enough that those kinds of things get worked out over time, and I think we were pretty much in agreement with this.
There are always discussions when the first collision occurs, when you're first reading, and you've worked on your part and your partner has worked on their part. You sit down together and it's my note, not yours.
That's another thing that a lot of people don't realize, is that sometimes the composer will write the same note in two parts at the same time. Parts, musically the parts will cross and both need the same note to complete the line, just
so
like
you have to be cognizant of how that note fits in your partner's part as well as how it fits in yours. And that's where the discussions come up. Mm. You know, how are we going to deal with this?
Well, why don't we pause here and listen to the first group of Hungarian dances, and I have about 50 more questions to ask you. So here we are. We'll be listening to selections recorded on the Centaur label of James and Catherine March for piano four hands of Johannes Brahms.
Thank you.
We've been listening to Drs. James and Catherine March performing Piano Four Hands and the first of five Hungarian dances of Johannes Brahms. We're going to talk about the recording process, but talk a little bit about the character and the flavor of these dances.
The dances are based on the national dance of Hungary, which was the Csárdás, and it has two parts. The first part is danced in a very stately, proud posture and is slow, and it's called the Lassú, L-A-S-S-U. And the second part is the Friss, F-R-I-S-S, which is a fast, whirling part, and it includes very fast foot snaps. And most of the dances in these first two sets that were published originally by Simrock are based on Csárdáshoz. They're written in that style.
And they really span the range of emotions. I mean, from triumphant to tragic to brooding to you just name it. That's part of what makes the set fun to play, I think, and fun to listen to, is that there is such a wide range of emotion involved.
I think it's fascinating that this recording on the Centaur label was actually done at Epley Auditorium. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, around this time that we did the recording, the piano in Epley was refurbished, and it's a magnificent concert grand Steinway. And we had a tremendous technician. His name was Charles Falk. Came in and did some work on the piano, and we just fell in love with it and decided that we wanted to record in Epley. And I think that when you're making a recording, if you can use the natural sound of the hall rather than trying to add reverb to something that was done in a small studio, you always wind up with a little bit more natural sounding recording. And so we wanted to do it in Epley. And the easiest time to do it was in the summer, which, you know, the hall was available. And we contacted a very fine recording engineer. His name was Peter Nothnagel from Iowa City, who I had worked with on another project earlier, and we got it set up, and he brought his equipment out, and the setup for a recording session takes quite a while. I mean, finding the exact perfect place to put the microphones. We spent several hours just trying to decide which pair of microphones we wanted to use, and we tried different things and did a little recording and listened to it, and, you know, sort of comparative listening. And once we got all those things worked out, we, you know, actually sat down and started playing the dances. You know, we'd work on one for a while, and then when we were satisfied, move on to the next. But choosing to do it in a hall rather than in a, you know, an isolated studio did cause a few problems. There were noises that we had to watch out for. I mean, I remember a couple of takes that we did. There would be a garbage truck out in the alleyway somewhere behind Epley Auditorium that would back up, and they have the little horn that beeps when they back up, and and Peter from the back room would holler, "Stop, take won't work," you know. So we had to back up, and there was a thunderstorm at one point. And we had to stop because the rain was so loud on the roof, and a number of things we had to avoid. And since it was in the summer, we have to have the air handling equipment off because it makes too much noise for during the recording. So it got very hot in the hall, and that meant that the tuning of the piano would kind of drift a little bit. And so we had a technician that was on hand, and about every, what would you say, every hour, hour and a half, we would take a short break, and the technician would have to come in and touch up some of the unisons on the piano. So there were a lot of obstacles that we had to dance between to get the to get the job done. But I'm really pleased with the sound that's on the disc. I think the piano sounds great, and I think Peter did a tremendous job on the recording. So we were overall pretty happy with it.
So I have to ask you, when you were going through this process, would these beautiful melodies and tunes play in your mind over and over and over?
It's 24/7. I mean, they get in your brain and they just don't go away sometimes.
They're rather infectious tunes anyway. I mean, anytime you hear them, you kind of walk away humming them. But yeah, you ruminate over them and you think about where you want to take time. And, you know, new things come to you as you listen to them in your head.
If you were doing the recording now as opposed to when you did it a few years ago, Would it be different?
I'm sure it would be different in some ways. I mean, we're a lot older now. I think we listen to things maybe in a little different way. We may focus on different elements in the music. And I think anytime you play a piece a lot, your mood at the time you play it affects the outcome of the piece. And I think there's always got to be that creative element when you're performing, and not a purely recreative thing where you just reproduce the same thing exactly over and over and over
That's
again.
One of
I think
his
that would be
things.
One of the most deadly things in a performance is to play it exactly the same way every time.
He always says there's no old music because it's always being recreated and it's in the moment, and he's right about that.
There's no old music,
interpretive
only old
stamp,
manuscripts.
Right. The interpretive stamp is always different.
How long did it take you to record all of the dances?
I think we spent about 2 days in Epley doing the recording once we had things set up. So.
And you went dance by dance, and were there multiple takes?
Many takes.
Absolutely.
Of each dance.
You get 3/4 of the way through, and then a noise would occur, you know, or the bench would squeak, or the pedal would suddenly decide to start making noises, and
Or Peter would shout in from the back room, that G sharp on top is going a little bit flat.
Oh,
you better call
that.
A technician.
Yes.
So we'd have to go stop. And so, yeah, there were a lot of things that you had to go back and rework. And then the agonizing process of sitting down after it's all over with and sorting through trying to decide which takes you like the best to put everything together is always a challenge.
And come to an agreement on that.
That's
well,
right.
I was going to ask you about how that happened.
Yeah. Well, actually, we both listened to
the
takes a lot.
Yeah,
but I think
he's better at the
editing.
Probably
spent a little bit more time with the editing part of it than Kathy did. But
well, the end result is wonderful, and we're so proud to have it in our library. And
Thank you. My
entire career here at the station, I always wanted to have this conversation with you because I've just been fascinated by this recording. Would you consider doing another recording? I mean, we're talking about the Hungarian dances, and while we were off mic, talking a little bit about the Dvorak Slavonic dances. Talk a little bit about that, and that was also published by Simrock.
Right, right. They're very similar in style, and they have that alternation of fast and slow. And proud posture of the Slavic dance style. They're very, very interesting pieces. And yeah, I think we'd entertain recording again. I don't know that we would publish it, but you know, maybe record.
Yeah.
Well, I think that would certainly be worth looking into. We're going to go back to a little more music, and then I want to hear about your upcoming Morningside College recital series,
okay.
Which I understand is going to be pretty exciting this year.
We're very proud of the series this year, yes.
So let's listen to another grouping of the Brahms Hungarian dances. We're going to start with number
6, which is Dance of the Rose Bush. So you can hear the pluck of the thorn.
Well, I'll look forward to that. Here then are Drs. James and Catherine March, piano four hands, for more of the Hungarian dances of Brahms. Thank you. The second grouping of Hungarian dances, featuring the very talented Doctors James and Catherine March for piano four hands of Brahms, and just so delighted to be sharing this time together with the both of you. Thank you very much. You know, as I said earlier, I've wanted to do this my entire career because I am fascinated by both of you and your great talent, but also the fact that this wonderful recording was made right here in Sioux City at Epley Auditorium. And you must have a million stories of recordings that you've done and the challenges. I'll just say it as challenges, not problems or difficulties, but challenges, because what goes into a recording, it's no light matter.
There are a lot of difficulties that you don't think about. I mean, squeaking benches and pianos drifting out of tune and noises from the outside and it's challenging. I think one of the hardest things about recordings is to keep your concentration doing the same piece over and over and over again you're trying to get a perfect recording, but you're also trying to get a really imaginative, creative performance out of it that doesn't sound like you're drilling it to death. And I think that's always a thing that's difficult in recording.
And as human beings, there are limitations to mm-hmm. your concentration, to, you know, the physicality of playing the piano. And probably most important, at least for me, would be patience. I mean, you mm-hmm. must be extraordinarily patient to make a recording.
It's a time-consuming process, that's for sure.
Jim's very patient. I'm not so much.
I'll remind you of that later.
Well, we're getting to the end of the program, and I've enjoyed every minute of this, but I don't want to forget that we have another series coming up as part of the Morningside College Piano Series, which you and Catherine have diligently worked on and beautifully developed over the years. So is it okay to ask if we could have a bit of a preview for the upcoming season, Jim?
Absolutely. We have 7 concerts on the series this year, and we're really proud of the people that are coming to Morningside. The first concert is going to be on Sunday, September 16th at 3 p.m., and Lydia Artemu from up in Minneapolis will be coming down. She's on the faculty at the University of Minnesota. She's been a concert artist for many years and a particularly well-known chamber musician in the Twin Cities area and really around the world. She's mm-hmm. played with many, many outstanding musicians, and she's going to be doing a recital for us. Her program is going to include, off the top of my head, I remember there's a Mozart sonata, the C major Mozart sonata, K330, as well as the Schumann Fantasiestück. So that should be a really great program. On October 6th, Shichao Zhang and Stephanie March are going to be doing a piano and cello duo recital, and that program will include the Rachmaninoff Sonata, which is a tremendous piece. It's not performed very often, but it's a really great work. And also the last of the Beethoven sonatas for piano and cello. And that's Saturday, October 6th at 7:30. The next recital is on Saturday, October 13th, just the following week. Those two are kind of close together. And our good friend Andy Rousseau will be back in town again to give another performance. And so we're
he's the first person to play contemporary music that used inside the piano at the Van Cliburn competition. And Andy's a good friend. He's been here a number of times.
And in November, November 3rd, Alan and Alvin Chow will be giving a duo piano recital, a two-piano recital. And so that should be a lot of fun. That's going to be a Saturday night at 7:30. And then in January, Yiyang Chen, he's on the faculty at East Tennessee State University. He'll be doing a recital. That's Saturday, January 19th at 7:30.
He's won numerous international competitions. Really a big rising star.
And then we're particularly proud on Valentine's Day, Thursday, February 14th at 7:30 p.m., the gold medalist from the 2017 Van Cliburn competition will be doing a recital here. Yequan Sun Wu, just easily one of the best pianists I've ever heard in my life. He is absolutely incredible. I hope everybody will come out and hear him. And then the final concert of the series is Douglas Humphreys. He's the chair of the piano department at Eastman School of Music. And that will be Friday, April 5th at 7:30 p.m. And he will be playing the Ravel Sonatine, the Dutilleux Sonata, which is a wonderful piece that's rarely heard. I think a very accessible piece, but absolutely a tour de force. And then the second half of the program will be the Liszt Sonata, the B minor Sonata by Liszt. So it should be a great, great season.
And you have a wonderful partnership with Siouxland Public Media. So as in the past, I'm wondering if some of these concerts will be recorded and broadcast at a later time.
I'm hoping that we can, I'm hoping that the artists will agree to do that. I mean, they've been very generous with their time in the past, and I would assume that that will continue, and I'm hoping that we can maybe even get a few live broadcasts put together this year.
Yeah. We're really grateful for the support. It's really incredible to have this type of a series here, and we've been told that by the artists. So it's really neat to be able to bring it to the people through Siouxland Public Media as well.
Well, it's a wonderful series, not only to hear the classics performed at such a high level, but, you know, the educational component mm-hmm. and that students get to interact with the different artists. I mean, you have really created something exceptional here, Jim.
Well, thank you. Thank you. We're really proud of the series, and it's been a lot of fun.
I can't believe an hour has flown by. When we started the program, I think we're all wondering how we're going to get from A to B, but obviously we accomplished that beautifully with your assistance. And I have so admired both of you and the work that you are doing, not just at Morningside College, but in this community to spread the mission of classical music. And the time today has, for me, been wonderful, and I want to thank you very much.
We've really enjoyed it.
We've enjoyed it, too.
Thank you, Gretchen.
And let me know when you're going to be recording the Dvorak Symphonic Dances, and we'll have another program. but wishing you well. And Jim, if people have questions about the piano series, is there a season ticket membership, or what can you tell them?
The concerts are absolutely free.
No kidding.
There is no admission charge for the concerts. If anybody wants more information, they can contact the music department at Morningside College, 274-5210. Or they can just send me an email directly, march@morningside.edu. And I'll be happy to put names on a mailing list. And we usually send out announcements in advance. And listen to KWIT for further updates.
All right. Well, a pleasure. Thank you, James and Catherine March, for discussing your recording featuring the Brahms-Hungarian Dances and hearing about all the great things you're doing, kind of behind the scenes of the recording and the history and all of that, and enjoyed it very much. And I know that our listeners have enjoyed it as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Gretchen.
This is Gretchen Gondek. Thank you for tuning in for Opus today. This is Siouxland Public Media, KWIT Sioux City 90.3. and KOJI Okoboji 90.7, broadcasting from the campus of Western Iowa Tech Community College.